Judiciary for this afternoon's program. We had posted possible measure introduction. I don't believe, Council, we have any bills to introduce today as committee bills. So we're going to move directly into the substance of our meeting today, which I think you'll find an extremely informative presentation on people with mental illness in our criminal justice system. I'll give Council Taylor an opportunity to briefly make some introductions to the committee. I know that we've had a couple of folks who've been in meetings during the lunch hour, and I expect they'll be coming in. And we may be joined by some other members of the legislature who had expressed an interest. We're certainly happy to have Representative March, who is not a member of our committee, but we welcome him here today to participate in this presentation. And feel free, Representative, to ask any questions that you would like to ask during the presentation as well.
Thank you.
And we'll extend that same courtesy to any other member of the legislature who wants to come and join us this afternoon. So, Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, this presentation is coming to you today from the Council and State Governments. I was back to New York on this project, Criminal Justice Mental Health Consensus Project. Unfortunately, I'd only get two copies of these left, if anyone's interested in hearing them. But what I'd like to do is turn the meeting over to Daniel Swain from the Council of State Governments, who will give you a brief outline of what the CSG is, what the project is, and then he will introduce the speakers today.
Please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Daniel Swain. I'm here from the Council of State Governments, which, as many of you may know, is a membership organization for state government officials, all elected and appointed officials. So it's a pleasure to be able to present to some of our members today. I'm coming to you today from the New York office, which is the Eastern Regional Office. There are four regional offices, but it's a national organization. To explain what brings us all the way out to Oregon, the Eastern Regional Office is the only regional office that has a criminal justice division. So many of the projects that we do end up being national in scope, and this is one such project. As Mr. Taylor said, the genesis of this presentation comes out of the Criminal Justice Mental Health Consensus Project, which the Council of State Governments has coordinated and we've been working on for a couple of years now. The purpose of the project is to bring together stakeholders from across the criminal justice and mental health system to come up with recommendations on how to improve the response to people with mental illness in the justice system. Mr. Taylor asked us to come out here to make a presentation to the Judiciary Committee after a meeting that we had with a number of legislative staff members. So we really appreciate the opportunity and the invitation. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I also want to thank and note that there are a number of Oregonians who worked on this project, and we appreciate their assistance. Senator Burdick, also Barry Cass from the Department of Human Services, Gary Field from the Department of Corrections, and also Richard Sherman from Lane County. I'd also like to point out that we're coming to you representing both Council of State Governments and also working together with the TAPA Center for Jail Diversion, which is part of the National Game Center, which is a national organization that's been a leader on the issues of mental illness in the criminal justice system. So we're coming to you presenting jointly under the auspices of both those organizations. As Mr. Taylor said, we'll be talking about issues of people with mental illness in the justice system. We have three presenters today. To my immediate left, Dr. Fred Osher, who's coming from the University of Maryland and was one of the steering committee members for the project. Next to him, David Wertheimer from Seattle, who has worked on issues in a number of places, including King County. And on my far left, Captain John Cassese from the Monroe County Jail, Monroe County Sheriff's Office. So again, we really appreciate the opportunity to present to you. We will go through the presentation with Dr. Osher and then Captain Cassese and Mr. Wertheimer. If there are any questions that come up, please feel free. And again, thank you very much. And without further ado, I'll turn it over to the presenters.
Thank you very much. Doctor, when you're going to be using the screen, would it help us to dim the lights, you think, in the room a little bit so we can see that?
It may, huh?
Yeah, let's see if that helps us out a little bit. How about there? That one.
That one.
Woo. Well, add that one and keep that one off. There we go. That's perfect. Is that all right with you, Doctor?
That's fine with me. And again, I wanted to add to
Daniels, thank you to you for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here, giving us an opportunity to share information with you about a topic that we work with on a day-to-day basis and is one of the many, many topics that you have to consider in your deliberations. It's also the case that we come here humble with humility and an appreciation of the circumstances that you find yourself in budgetarily here. We watched with you Measure 28. We know the outcome of that, and we appreciate that and other issues will create some challenges for all of us in determining how to use these scarce resources most effectively. We hope that the comments today, sharing some of what's going on around the country, understanding of the problem, and both some of the solutions that others have come up to, might inform some of the deliberations that you make down the road in choosing how to use those scarce resources most effectively. So with an awareness that both nationally, states around the country are facing these issues, and here in Oregon it's particularly pressing at this time. And even more of a thank you for taking time out of your schedule in this period to meet with us today. I want to talk about at the outset how we find ourselves with so many individuals with mental illness in the criminal justice system. And in order to do that, I think we need to sort of look a step back a bit and look at the landscape around criminal justice broadly. In this country, we've gone through a rapid increase in the incarceration rates. In 1990, one in every 218 residents were incarcerated. In the year 2000, one in every 142 of our citizens were incarcerated. Now we have over 2 million people held in prisons and jails around the country. Nearly 4 million people are on probation and parole. That's 3% of our population, a higher per capita percentage than any other developed country in the world. And importantly, this isn't a random slice of our population that is involved with the criminal justice system. There is a vast overrepresentation of people of color in the system compared to our demographics, and there is a vast overrepresentation of people with mental illness in our criminal justice system. A Bureau of Justice Statistics survey found across prisons, jails, and community corrections that roughly 16% of those individuals had a serious mental illness, which is anywhere from 3 to 5 times the rates of mental illness in the general population. In Oregon, the most recent data we got from the Department of Corrections says about 12% of the incarcerated prisoners meet the state criteria for a severe and persistent mental illness. An additional 9% of those individuals require mental health treatment. And that's a large number. It creates a lot of problems and incurs major costs for the correction systems at this point. It is also the case that there is a large percentage of folks in our mental health systems that have criminal justice backgrounds. So when you walk into a community mental health center, it is often the case that you've spent time in jail and prison. And our mental health providers have got to learn and get accustomed to and familiar with working with this population, its background, and its needs as well. I want to talk about the factors that create this overrepresentation. Then we'll turn it over to Captain John Cassese to talk about the criminal justice perspective and come back to some of the cost issues that I think are very relevant for considerations at this time. When one looks at the rates of mental illness again in the general population, this is from a well-designed study in Cook County in Chicago, you see that about 1.8% of the general population meet criteria for a serious mental illness. Of the male jail detainees, about 6.4% met criteria in this study, and the females about 15%. And importantly, when you then look at those individuals in the jails with serious mental illness and look about at their additional complicating factors, 3/4 of those individuals will have a co-occurring substance use disorder, either alcohol abuse or dependence or other drug abuse and dependence. So that's really an important factor, so that the modal person, the average person in jail and prison with serious mental illnesses, also has a co-occurring substance use disorder. Why are there so many there? First and foremost, folks with mental illness are arrested at disproportionately higher rates. How else would you get in jail and prison? Now, why is that the case? I've already alluded to one of the factors, the co-occurrence of substance use disorders. we've had since the 1980s, a war on drugs in this country with a lot of policy implications in terms of mandatory sentencing guidelines, and our jail and prison population expansion is directly related to increase in drug-related offenses. Folks with serious mental illness use drugs and alcohol at rates higher than the general population. So if you're sweeping in a group of individuals for drug-related offenses, you're going to catch an awful lot of those folks with serious mental illness as well. Another factor in the high arrest rates that I want to dispel in some way is the notion that there's this striking connection between mental illness and violence. This argument is complicated, with more myth and stereotypes surrounding it than facts. In fact, when one looks at studies that are well-designed, the rates of violence of folks with mental illness are no higher than rates of violence in the general population. And that's what comes through. We do have to acknowledge that violence is a very rare event. And when it happens, we often get these large media portrayal of them, and the connection between mental health and violence is in our culture, but not well supported by the data. There are some conditions under which a person with mental illness is more prone to violence, and we've learned that as well. They include, if they've had a violent act before, they're more likely than the average person to have it again. Secondly, if they're not taking psychiatric medications that would help their illness, either they're not taking it because they don't want to or they don't have access to it, that is related to violence. And thirdly, and most importantly, it's a substance use disorder. Violence in this country is substance use related, and that's what drives most of the data that we're going to look at. The next reason why folks with mental illness are found in those settings at higher rates is that they spend more time incarcerated for exactly the same offense and the same sentence. So why would that be? Well, we'll hear from the captain later on. When folks with mental illness go into these settings, they tend to have behavioral problems that capture the attention of the correctional staff. They end up with administrative segregation, housing segregation. They max out their sentences more often than folks without mental illness. And so one Bureau of Justice Statistics study found that individuals with mental illness, same crime, same sentence, spent 15 months longer in prison than those without mental illness. And this was true in Rikers Island, a jail in New York City. Longer stays, same crime. Third reason why there are so many folks with mental illness in our jails and prisons is the pathogenic nature of incarcerated environments. And with all due respect to the captain here, who operates, I'm sure, a facility that's safe and secure, they're not comfortable. They're crowded, they're noisy, the stimulation levels are high, and if you don't have a mental illness but have a vulnerability to one, you might express it there. Or if you do have a mental illness and are exposed to that degree of stimulation, it's disorienting and results in a higher severity of the illness symptoms. Third, the high recidivism rates on reentry. We have not done a good job generally planning for people coming out of incarcerated settings, specifically for folks with mental illness. There was a lawsuit in New York City for Rikers Island. They have 25,000 inmates with mental illness come in and out. The modal discharge plan for that individual was a ride to Queens somewhere between 2 and 4 in the morning, a drop-off, $1.50 change, and a pat on the back. That didn't result in very long tenure in the community. They ended up rearrested regularly and became part of the revolving door scenario that correctional staff are all too familiar with. And that's not an exception at Rikers Island. We just don't plan well for release. We have about 600,000 individuals coming out of our state and federal prisons this year. They're coming out whether we like it or not. They're coming back to our communities whether we plan for them or not. They're coming back whether they get treatment and supports or not. And we have to consider the impact on the system in providing adequate care on reentry. The last factor, it would be unfair to point fingers at the justice system. I'm a psychiatrist. We got to take our hits. Generally, in this country, there are inadequate access to mental health services. This is a specific issue for you in Oregon today as you face some of the budget cuts and some of the consequences that might be a result of that. What we know in the mental health field is that folks with serious mental illness need an array of services, and oftentimes these are quite fragmented and difficult to put together, and case management is often necessary to coordinate it. We also know that access to care, limits to benefits, being disenrolled from insurance plans, cuts to Medicaid, all decrease our access to care for folks with mental illness. The Surgeon General issued a report 2 years ago. Nearly two-thirds of all people with diagnosable mental illnesses receive no treatment. With stigma as one of the principal reasons that drives policy that doesn't allow for parity in insurance and may not fund mental health services adequately. There's a huge irony here in that we in the mental health field over the last 20 years have made advances in our science that are comparable to any other field of medicine in terms of producing good outcomes, and that we know what works, we know how to implement what works, and we know how to get good outcomes with successful programs. The irony is that so few people have access to these interventions. So even though we have a sound knowledge base, we haven't put it into practice in ways that we'll learn later may have consequences in cost terms outside of the health field. You have specific issues to consider here. I'll just raise what I'm learning from the papers, and you all know this better than I. Understand, not related to Measure 8 necessarily, but methadone slots are drying up. You're going to lose about 5,000 methadone slots related to loss of insurance. 3,000 of those individuals can be expected to return to heroin use at a cost of about $200 million of heroin. Where are they going to get the heroin? Well, they obviously are going to be involved in some of our public safety concerns and results in arrest and result in legal processing and the like. So sometimes those health-related cuts have consequences in non-health-related budgets. In fact, the literature suggests that paying for methadone treatment for just the health cost cut them in half. So if you take away the methadone, we've doubled the health cost, and then you add up all the other costs related to crime and some of the criminal justice issues. So these are tough choices that all of you face, and they're facts that will sort of make our strategic planning necessarily very thoughtful and a little bit more long-term than short-term, even though crisis is upon us here. The story that I just told around mental illness and criminal justice system is that we arrest those folks more often, we stress them while they're incarcerated, we keep them incarcerated longer, we discharge them without adequate planning, they don't get access to adequate mental health care, they get rearrested more often, becoming part of this revolving door, and so we have an issue that raises both health and public safety concerns. The challenge is, what can criminal justice do differently? What can mental health and substance abuse do differently? And most importantly, how can they work together? Because we've seen solutions that have sprung from either one or other of those silos that don't seem to have the impact and effectiveness that we'd like. And what we've learned is that coordination and collaboration is essential. There are many things going on at the national level around this. Multi-site jail diversion projects are up. Oregon has had funding for those. There are technical assistance opportunities from the TAPA Center, who is partially responsible for this, the Council of State Governments as well. We are learning at the federal level and promulgating what we call evidence-based practice initiative. That is, let's take what we know works and let's make sure that we spend our scarce resources on that at least. If there are excess resources, then we can think about what to spend beyond that. We've had mental health court legislation passed at the federal level. There's a $100 million reentry program that was passed in collaboration with labor, HHS, and justice. And we know that there are proposed legislative activity that may bring more money from the federal level into addressing this particular problem. At this point, I want to turn my mic over to Captain John Cassese to discuss the criminal justice perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is John Cassese. I am a captain at the Monroe County Jail in Rochester, New York. I would like to thank the Oregon House Judiciary Committee for allowing me to speak before you today. I'd also like to thank my sheriff, Patrick O'Flynn, for allowing me to represent our jail. And I'd also like to thank the Oregon Sheriff's Association. Last June, I was fortunate enough to testify before the United States Senate Judiciary Committee about the issue of people with mental illness in the criminal justice system. I'm grateful to have had the chance to address this committee, which also is working to address these issues. Speaking for corrections officers across the country, I can tell you that identifying inmates with mental illness, treating, managing, and preparing them for release is one of the greatest, if not the single greatest, challenges we face in corrections today. I now would like to focus the remainder of my time on the following areas: give you some information about the Monroe County Jail and how it compares to jails in Oregon, describe who are the people with mental illness who end up in our jails, explain what services we provide to these inmates, talk about the impact people with mental illness have on our jails in terms of safety, security, and the resources that are required to manage them in a safe manner during their incarceration, and then address the implications for jails when community mental health services are reduced or eliminated. On any given day, there are about 1,400 inmates in our jail. Around 400 of these inmates are serving sentences of 1 year or less in our sentence facility, which is about 3 miles from our downtown facility. The remaining 1,000 inmates are pretrial detainees and are held in the downtown jail. We also provide security at the Rochester Psychiatric Center, which is a regional forensic unit in Rochester. Like most jails, the average length of stay for inmates in our facility is relatively short. Over the course of a year, over 17,000 inmates are booked into our jail. In comparison, Multnomah County has over 1,800 inmates in their 5 jail facilities, with 1,100 sentenced inmates and about 750 pretrial detainees. Like every county in the country, our jail has experienced explosive growth over the last 2 decades. Our facility also resembles most jails in that it's the county's largest mental health facility. No other institution in Monroe County holds nearly as many people with mental illness as does our county jail. And Multnomah is in a similar situation. And it's just not right. We work in a jail, and our job really is to incarcerate offenders, not to hospitalize sick people. Between 15 and 20% of the inmates in our jail have a mental illness, which is consistent with most jails in the country. I want to be clear that we incarcerate many offenders who have committed serious, violent crimes, and some of those people have a mental illness. They need to be punished and require incarceration. There are no two ways about it. But the majority of the people we see with mental illness in our jail aren't murderers or sex offenders, or even criminals with a history of violence. They are people who have been in and out of our jail on countless occasions, charged with or convicted of committing low-level offenses. We don't blame law enforcement officers for taking these people to our jail. They often don't have any other option. I want to tell you a story about a typical individual with mental illness who was recently brought to our jail. It was a 34-year-old man with a history of mental illness who wrote a letter stating he was God and how he was going to save the world. He also had stopped taking his medications for several days. He had been giving his family a difficult time, and the police became involved because he became very threatening. He had been arrested one time prior in his early 20s for very similar circumstances. The police took the man for an evaluation at a local psychiatric emergency room where he was deemed not sick enough to be held, so they had no other option than to take him to jail. Due to his mental health history and unstable condition at the time, because he was not taking his medication, we placed him in a single cell on a 24-hour constant observation watch. I'd like to explain how we work to identify, treat, and plan for the release of people with mental illness who come into the jail. Screening. In New York State, we are unique in that each jail uses the same screening process. At our jail, we screen everyone who is admitted to the jail for mental illness. The State Office of Mental Health developed one form in particular, which is nationally recognized, the Suicide Prevention Screening Guideline Form. This screening process used in our jail and other jails in New York State has caused suicides to drop by 70% over the last decade. In addition, in our jail, we use 2 additional forms for medical and mental health screening by booking officers. Also, security command officers have a regularly scheduled daily meeting Monday through Friday with medical and mental health staff to discuss inmates with serious mental health issues or who are at risk of committing suicide. Next, I'd like to mention release planning. Good release planning is paramount. We know an effective discharge plan includes appointments with community-based treatment providers, a short supply of medications, health coverage, and linkage to supportive housing. We have better successes planning for the release of our sentenced inmates because we know in advance of their date of release. Meeting all of those objectives is difficult, but is nearly impossible with the pretrial detainees. We often receive less than 2 hours advance notice of those inmates' departure. This is a major problem and frustration for jail administrators across the country. When we release people with mental illness without a community-based treatment plan and linkage to a community-based provider, we know the odds are good that he or she will be back soon. Without health coverage, it's nearly impossible for most of these people to receive care or obtain medications. Although many are eligible for Medicaid, few are actually enrolled in the benefit program. The impact of this situation on the people with mental illness and on jail operations is very difficult. Inmates with mental illness do not do well in jails across this country. They sometimes act out and violate rules, which means we have to reassign them, as Frank talked earlier, to segregation or high security cells, which we typically reserve for really dangerous inmates. Inmates with mental illness are also vulnerable to predatory inmates. Jails are not therapeutic environments. They're depressing, and they're not nice places that make people feel better. The influx of people with mental illness makes running the jail more costly and more dangerous. Every day there are five areas in the jail where we are watching inmates with mental health problems with three deputies assigned to constant observation duties, with an average of 10 to 12 inmates who are on suicide watch and another 20 to 25 inmates who need to be watched more closely. That might not sound like much, but making sure someone is always watching these inmates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in a high security area is extremely staff intensive and very expensive. Nevertheless, this degree of supervision is necessary to ensure a safe environment. In 2002, in the Monroe County Jail, besides jail deputies working their normal hours in our constant observation areas, we used 8,350 hours of overtime to watch inmates with mental illness on constant observation at a cost of $315,000. The Sociolegal Mental Health Clinic of Monroe County, who provides the mental health services at the jail, last year had a cost of $425,000 for services and $240,000 for psychotropic drugs. That total of $665,000 is only mental health coverage Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., not the required and needed 24-hour-a-day mental health coverage 7 days a week. After 4 o'clock p.m. and on weekends, if there is an acute situation with an inmate with serious mental health issues, they must be taken to a local hospital psychiatric emergency room, which is even more costly than treating the inmate at the jail. A recent study conducted for Monroe County by a professional correctional health care consultant concluded that a total of $1.5 million annually is needed at the present time to cover the existing mental health needs at the jail 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, I agree that we need to expand and improve the mental health services in our jails. However, I am reluctant to advocate for extensive mental health services in our jails. As it is, we receive too many people with mental illness, and this is true in county jails across the country, including Oregon. Most importantly, and what really needs to be taken into account, is that jails return people with mental illness to the community many times in no better shape than when they were brought into the jail. For this reason, I would prefer to see in Monroe County and communities across the country the community's capacity to improve and to support people with mental illness in the community improve. If there are reductions in mental health services in the community, it would without a doubt cause a further need to increase mental health services provided in our jails. And the cost of managing and treating mentally ill people in the criminal justice system is far more expensive for government and the taxpayers than treating them in a more therapeutic environment with all of the supports and their families in a community-based treatment program. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain. I'm sure as compared to the Senate Judiciary Committee and Congress, we're small potatoes, but we do appreciate you making the trip out here to talk to us, and your information was very helpful.
I appreciate you having me.
So with a statement of the problem, we want to move on to a discussion about what are the potential solutions there. And this is an issue that isn't unique to Oregon and is national in scope. Was brought to the attention of the Council of State Governments, which is your representative organization, in an effort to develop a response that the legislators could stand behind, would understand, appreciate, is informed. Daniel gave you an overview of CSG. The Consensus Project was a national initiative to define measures that all stakeholders in criminal justice and mental health systems would agree would improve responses to people with mental illness in the justice system. Why did it come about? It was to prevent tragedies from driving policy. We all know of the high media, high profile events in communities that then the citizenry says, do something, and we get some laws passed, Paula's law or Kendra's law or whatever, and that oftentimes those laws, while responsive to the public, may not be as informed and may have unintended consequences. So part of this initiative was, what can we learn proactively that might be done? We want to preempt the possibility of federal mandates from coming into states that would then make the budget problems even worse. We wanted to establish a forum to consult stakeholder groups which appear to have conflicting views on the issue. And the remarkable thing about that large book that was published is it represents consensus. There's a lot of issues that people don't agree on. But we wanted to make sure that this book represented all those issues, which was far greater in number, that people did share a perspective and views on. We also wanted to provide a resource to practitioners in the criminal justice and mental health systems and to policymakers. And this is our, we wanted to help respond to current state budget crises. This is an old slide. This is a new and ongoing crisis that you're dealing with here. There are issues, as the captain highlighted, in which, you know, if you underfund the community resources and we end up putting more people in jail and prison, there's only one place in this country where you have a constitutional right to health care, and that's in jail and prison. So when you land there, people have got to do what the Constitution asked them to do in terms of services, and they become high cost, as was articulated by the captain. The central features of the report is that it was bipartisan. This is not a Republican issue. This is not a Democratic issue. The two chairs of the project were Senator Thompson from Pennsylvania, who's a Republican, and Representative Lawler from Connecticut, who's a Democrat. And we wanted to make sure that we didn't cast this in any partisan way. This is a community issue, not a partisan issue. And that we emphasize cross-system collaboration. You'll hear a lot more about that, and consensus. It was organized with a steering committee. We had advisory groups. We had meetings all over the country. It was an elaborate process that resulted in testimony to the U.S. Senate. You'll see on the far left a slightly younger Captain John, but not that much younger, who's helped with this process throughout. The overarching themes of the report are collaboration, training, effective mental health systems, evaluation, and local solutions. The collaboration is critical. As I mentioned earlier, it can't be the criminal justice system designing a response. They need to have substance abuse and mental health partners at the table to do that. We need local solutions. We're not here from out of town to tell you how to do your business. You know that best. And I understand there's been a mechanism that this body has sponsored called, I think the acronym is LipSync. Is that right, Mr. Taylor? LipSync? Yeah, which is a coordinating group at the local level which has representation from a variety of the agencies. And those are the type of mechanisms that folks around the country are using to develop plans, and that maybe that's something that can be piggybacked on in the future. There are some fiscal applications that David Wertheimer is going to discuss in detail, but the take-home message that we want you to leave here with is that it's significantly more expensive to provide mental health and substance abuse treatment in the criminal justice system than in the community, that the majority of the individuals with mental illness in the system are these revolving door clients. As the captain said, we're not soft on crime. People that commit heinous acts, you know, need punishment and incarceration. It's the misdemeanors that are in and out, costing the system thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that we're looking at. And that coordinated efforts between criminal justice and mental health systems are necessary to use the resources more effectively. So at this point, I want to turn it over to David Wertheimer to discuss some of the cost findings that might inform the argument here in Oregon.
Good afternoon. My name is David Wertheimer. I'm the principal consultant with Kelly Point Partners in your sister state to the north, Washington State, out of Seattle. And it's a pleasure to be here. I know that both of our states are facing considerable challenges around our budgets right now. The advantage you have here is that As legislators, you get to do it from inside your own house. The Washington State Legislature is currently operating out of temporary buildings that have been in place since the Nisqually quake. So it's nice to actually be inside of a state capitol as opposed to in some temporary building that you think is going to go down in the next quake that comes along. I'd like to talk a little bit about measuring dollars and cents and the price tags related to the incarceration of people with severe and persistent mental illnesses. There's been a lot of research on this subject, and it points very, very clearly in the directions that Fred and John have both been talking about this afternoon, and that is that it costs a lot to continually reincarcerate, rehospitalize individuals with severe and persistent mental illness who don't necessarily get any better as a result of those jail episodes. And it actually costs less when you look at expenses across multiple systems to provide community-based treatment and support and housing for these individuals. Here's a little bit of data from two specific studies, one in Cook County in Illinois and another in John's hometown of Rochester, New York, in Monroe County. The first study looked at costs of a subset of the population with severe and persistent mental illnesses in the Cook County Jail before and after they were engaged in intensive diversion programming designed to move them out of the incarceration setting into intensive treatment and supported housing and away from the revolving door of the criminal justice system. When you look across the multiple systems that all have to pay for the incarceration, the reincarceration, and the ongoing hospital and jail-based costs of treating or dealing with a person who's not being treated, your price tag in Cook County came out at about $54,000 a year. For the same population of individuals, once they were diverted and placed into intensive treatment in the community and housing, the cost actually went down by almost $19,000 to about $35,000 per person per year. In Monroe County, in a small program called Project Link, a small group of individuals were followed in a similar fashion. The tally of costs across multiple systems for these individuals prior to their involvement at the program was calculated at about $74,000 per person per year. Phenomenal cost. After involvement in the program, a $39,000 reduction to about $34,000 to treat and house an individual in the community in a fashion that reduces their reliance on jail prison costs. Two other studies I just want to cite briefly, looking specifically at local jail diversion, and there are many different ways these studies have been configured. This is a program in Tucson and another one here in Oregon, in Eugene, that looked at the average cost per person of non-diverted populations, that is, individuals with mental illness who were not being diverted, and the average cost per person for jail for these individuals, for criminal justice system involvement, was about $11,000, or $15,000 in Eugene. When these individuals are diverted and placed in intensive treatment in the community, such that they are not being reincarcerated, the cost is actually, in these two studies, pretty much a wash. You pay a little bit more, actually, $857 in Tucson, $421 here in Eugene, to house and treat these individuals. The difference is that these are individuals who are now going to be on a path to recovery, on a path to wellness, on a path to stability, which is the opposite direction of what happens, as John indicated, when you incarcerate someone in an environment that's not conducive to their stabilization and recovery. So here in these studies indicates that for paying about the same amount of money, you can actually do a lot better for your citizenry when you're actually diverting them and linking them to care.
David, if I could, on the studies, these two studies particularly that show a slightly increased cost, did it also follow sort of the long-term impact of their reduced contact with the system, or is this purely static costs, diversion versus non-diversion?
Yeah, I just had a chance to review the Oregon report specifically, and excellent question. These are the one-year follow-up costs, short-term. One might predict that long-term benefits would be greater than this, that you have actually started people in, as David mentioned, that treatment mode. So that is something that's predicted, but the evaluators weren't following those people long-term.
But theoretically, to the extent that you cut the number of contacts back to the system down from,
correct,
say, 5 in another 12-month period to 2, those costs could be recouped over a longer period of time.
Correct.
Reduce contacts.
It's the effect is cumulative.
Do you know on the Eugene study whether or not they're continuing to track Are they going to go beyond the 1 year? Or?
No, it was a pilot demonstration program, and they implemented it and then followed the cohort, and I don't believe they have new resources to do the longitudinal study.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Did Eugene provide you with that data?
There was a report that is labeled by the governance groups that was submitted to, but I believe that Richard Sherman was a principal in the project and would follow up with him.
One more study I want to cite, which is perhaps the most comprehensive study of its type to date, looking at expenses across systems that are incurred by government sectors in dealing with this population. It's a study that Dennis Culhane and a group of colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania did in New York City. It's called the New York, New York Study. And what they looked at were people who were homeless and severely mentally ill in New York, and looked at the cost of those individuals as homeless individuals to the system prior to linking them to housing and supportive services, and after. What they found was that these homeless individuals in New York City had spent about 37% of the last 2 years in institutional settings, either jail or hospital. As John indicated, jails often become the primary residence for these individuals, and the jail, Rikers Island, the Los Angeles County Jail, are the largest mental health housing facilities in their jurisdictions. Providing services for people who are homeless and mentally ill is very expensive. Looking across multiple systems in New York City, about $40,500 a year per person. Providing housing and attendant supportive services to try and keep these folks housed in New York City reduced those costs by about 30%, $12,000 a year compared to $40,000 a year. And what's interesting is when you look across systems, despite the fact that supportive housing costs are expensive, 94% of that supportive housing cost is actually offset or mitigated by service reductions and the lesser intensity of care that individuals require, from frequent visits to hospital emergency rooms, frequent psychiatric hospitalizations, and frequent episodes of reincarceration in the criminal justice system. So taking these dollar figures, how do we make sense out of them? How do we measure sense? And I want to talk a little bit about King County, where I worked in local government for 10 years, about how we tried to make sense out of this from a very, very senseless and disturbing incident that occurred in August of 1997. And you actually have had a somewhat similar incident that just occurred here not too long ago in Oregon. You may be familiar or remember from the newspapers the story of Dan Van Ho. Dan Van Ho was a man who lived in Seattle, and he was severely mentally ill, and also had frequent problems with substance use. He stole a bicycle. He stole a pretty cheap bicycle, so he was charged with a misdemeanor offense. And because of his mental illness, he was evaluated and found not competent to stand trial. In Seattle, in Washington State, in 1997, an individual who was charged with a misdemeanor offense who was found not competent to stand trial was released. Charges were dropped. Dan Van Ho was scheduled for release from jail. The officers in jail were concerned about him, knew that he was volatile, knew that he was at risk for violence, but there was nothing they could do. And I actually talked to the officers who escorted him out of the sally port of the jail in August, and they said they actually tried to crowd him and jostle him just a little bit to see if they could get him to go off so they could get him back in jail, because they didn't feel comfortable releasing him, but they couldn't prevent it. 11 days later, Stanley Stevenson, a retired Seattle firefighter, fire captain actually, was leaving the Kingdome, which doesn't exist anymore, after a sporting event, and he was with his family. Dan Van Ho ran into the crowd and stabbed him to death. It's an enormous crisis, the kind of crisis that Fred was talking about, gets a lot of media attention, and the initial instinct of many of my bureaucrat colleagues at King County, of course, was to run for cover and to start pointing fingers saying, well, no, it wasn't my department that did that, it wasn't you, it wasn't this, it wasn't that. The county executive, Ron Sims, who many of you probably know in King County, Ron, within 24 hours, decided not to run away from the crisis, but he ran right towards it, right dead center. And within 24 hours, he had convened a mentally ill offender task force, which he said he wanted to have study the problem and propose solutions so that Stanley Stevenson was the last person who would die in a situation such as this. That mentally ill offender task force did a number of things. First of all, it looked at some data. And this data confirms what Fred and John have been saying to us for King County. 10% of our misdemeanor population utilize 70% of the jail misdemeanor bed days. That revolving door, 10% of your population, 70% of your days. Persons with mental illness were disproportionately overrepresented in this group, even more than they were represented disproportionately in the overall jail population. And 90% of these individuals in King County, similar to the 75% figure that Fred mentioned, 90% of these folks in King County also had co-occurring substance use disorders. That's what the jail told us. What the mental health system told us was also very interesting. We asked the mental health system to study all of the cofactors to incarceration and hospitalization for youth, adults, and older adults with severe and persistent mental illness. What is it that leads to increased episodes and costs in the hospital and in the jail? We found two statistically significant cofactors, and only two. We looked at diagnosis, we looked at age, we looked at gender, we looked at ethnicity, we looked at all kinds of different things. None of them were statistically significant as predictors of incarceration and hospitalization, save for two factors: co-occurring substance use disorders and homelessness, which led the county to the conclusion that if it could begin to address the issue of co-occurring substance use disorders among people with mental illness and homelessness, we could begin to address the costs that were driving our hospitals and our jails to spiral out of control. The budget implications in King County, similar across the country, similar across the Northwest. We're spending two-thirds of our current expense dollars at the county level on criminal justice system services. Despite the presence of 2,400 jail beds in King County at a projected 5% annual growth rate, which was where we were a few years ago, a new jail would be required by 2010. And again, the county powers that be said, no, wait a minute, there must be a way to avoid the capital expense and the operating expense, the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of capital and operating expense associated with building a new jail. They said, find us alternatives. Find us strategies for cost avoidance, which is to say, divert from jail those individuals who can be diverted safely and find ways to treat them in the community. The Mentally Ill Offender Task Force, to do this, made a series of recommendations. I want to focus on three of them that really have significant implications for all of us in King County, but also I think are replicable for other communities. One is that it's at a state level there was a review and adjustment of the statutory gaps and barriers that allowed Dan Van Hoddy to get out of jail in the first place without being somehow linked to mental health treatment for his dangerousness. The second was the creation of model or pilot mental health courts at the King County District Court and Seattle Municipal Court levels. And the third was the creation of a crisis triage unit at the county hospital. At the state statutory level, laws were passed, the statutes were amended to ensure that dangerous individuals exiting the criminal justice system are linked to assessment and treatment. In addition, the state promoted partnerships between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Social and Health Services in Washington State, where mental health services live, and asked them to design, develop, and implement new models of care that provided an integrated response to people who are exiting out the back door of our state correctional facilities after extended periods of incarceration. People who were, as Fred describing, the max-out folks, and particularly the pilot projects that were mobilized in Washington State, the max-out folks who have committed the most serious crimes, murder, rape, etc., people who are severely mentally ill and have spent 10, 20 years incarcerated and are returning to the community. And this created a pilot project called the Community Transitions Project, which I can talk about later if there's time and interest. The mental health courts. It's just involved over the last year with an evaluation of the Seattle Municipal Court Mental Health Court with some staff from the University of Washington. What did we find about this mental health court model? Well, first of all, the court was in fact serving the target population of people with severe and persistent mental illness, and new bookings for these individuals decreased significantly after mental health court involvement. We looked at them 18 months prior to mental health court involvement, 18 months post. We found, however, that the average number of jail days per booking increased if a mental health court client was rearrested. So we had a decrease in the number of bookings, but an increase in the number of jail days, which we suggested was related to a winnowing out of the more serious and dangerous criminals from the folks who were just using jail as a revolving door. And so mental health court actually helped us to identify the individuals who were a lower risk in terms of public safety and engage them in treatment that prevented them from revolving back into the jail. The court also was effective in linking clients to needed mental health case management services, to medication, emergency housing and related treatment and supports, and the mental health court clients, their participation in this program was associated with an increase in the number of treatment episodes they received over time. And the research clearly tells us that those doses of treatment, if you will, to which individuals can be exposed over time actually increase the likelihood of engagement and participation in meaningful care. Crisis triage, another example of a program that came out of this mentally ill offender initiative. The goal of crisis triage is to divert individuals from jail before they're arrested, as opposed to the mental health court, which is a post-arrest process, to get people away from the front door of the jail, to get them away from the front door of the hospital, and to find alternatives to the most expensive, most restrictive forms of care, jail and hospital, in our system, as well as to link these individuals to ongoing treatment and support. The crisis triage program, which is located in King County at the Harborview Medical Center, which is a county hospital, opened in 1999. It serves currently about 700 people a month. It's a busy, busy place. A third of those individuals that come to triage are brought by the police. They are the biggest single customer of triage, which is as we wanted it to be. Many of those individuals, the police tell us, would have been taken to jail had there not been an alternative. About a quarter of them, and this is very difficult to measure, but there's some instrumentation that's been developed by the University of Washington staff that helps us determine how many of these folks are actually being diverted from the hospital, another very expensive source of a cost center, and about one quarter of the individuals that come to triage leave without going to the hospital. Now, the average cost to treat them in triage is between $350 and $500 per person. That sounds expensive. But when you compare that to an inpatient cost at 5 to 7 days of $800 to $1,000 per day for that psychiatric hospitalization, you begin to realize that there are significant cross-system cost savings to be realized by diverting people away from your more restrictive inpatient settings. Backdoor staff were utilized to promote successful linkage to community care, and rather than having triage become a revolving door, we actually saw a reduction in the utilization of crisis services when effective linkages were occurring, and so we were able to successfully demonstrate that you can divert people from jail and hospital if the right array of resources are present. Lessons learned from this: cost shifting to the criminal justice system is a very expensive and losing proposition over time. It loses you both money and it loses you lives. Investing in community-based diversion programs saves money and lives, and effective diversion requires collaboration and integration across systems. I'm going to skip over to the next slide. Pilot projects represent a modest investment that demonstrate the potential to reduce the hemorrhaging of people and dollars from community to institutional settings. And here, coming back to a point Fred made, which I think is critically important, spend dollars on what you know works. You have some wonderful evidence-based best practice models here in Oregon. There are others in other parts of the country that can be expanded, that can be replicated. As Ken Minkoff, who's one of the gurus of this work, says, that mental health system is brilliant, probably the best system in the country for developing models of care that work, evidence-based best practice models. And we're one of the worst systems in the country for actually implementing and replicating those models. This means, in particularly in times of acute budget crisis, as we're experiencing in Washington, as I know you're experiencing here, means looking very carefully at what you do fund now. And looking at things and looking at the outcomes of what you fund now in terms of what works and what doesn't work. In very difficult times like these, what doesn't work, I encourage you to get rid of it. Replace it with things that will work better. So, in terms of what the legislature can do, Fred, do you want to dive in on this?
I'll take a stab at it. And I'm certainly not in a position of telling you how to do your business, but we've watched folks around the country struggle with these issues. And there are some areas that you can consider at this time, even in the context of budget crises.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I'm pleased to see some text come up on that slide because I was struck that your pages are blank. What can the legislature do? I'm relieved.
Representative Chatterley, the rest of us actually had the
look. Really?
It's just you we left out.
Keep me in the dark.
Well, I won't delve into the internal politics of that. But
okay, no revenue for you.
It's a little self-serving for me as an evaluator to push research, but we do need to know better what's going on, and we need to evaluate what we do to ensure that we get the outcomes that we care about. There fortunately is good data out there and a number of evidence-based practices, particularly in the mental health arena, that we can draw upon to guide your deliberations. I would, even though it's not on the slide, we're aware in our work over time of a very, very talented group of folks you have in the executive branch here in Oregon, and that clearly what this is going to require is a bringing together of legislative and executive talent in problem-solving mode. And beyond that, at the state level, there are those local groups that we've encouraged folks to look towards for the developing of contextualized solutions to this. The funding issue we've identified is, you know, if you got a dime to spend it on something that works. And we want to look carefully at that. Legislators all over the country are doing the same thing as they think about cuts. And we want to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater in some of the proposals that are there. The collaboration between agencies really needs to be supported. That's what we've understood, is that you actually sit at the right spot for this. Everyone else in their agency silos are concerned about their budget and the impact on their programs. But what taxpayer really needs is your help in looking broadly at the system to say, okay, we might spend a little more in this silo, but it'll save over in this silo. And that's not easy to do if you're within the silo. So your eyes are really critical in designing solutions for the system. And that was the foster collaboration and silo busting alternative there. So I think at this point we're going to close with our formal comments, invite questions, and your own reactions.
Thank you, Doctor. I on your last point is one that I know that it's been frustrating for me over the last 4 years, and I think for others who have sort of participated in similar programs and heard similar information, to deal with what seems like such a currently fragmented system. And I think there are sort of bright glimmers of hope at various points throughout the system, but from sort of a top-down look, it seems awfully fragmented. And one of the questions that just came to my mind is, we've had these discussions, and I know I've had various groups who come in and talk to me and say that, for example, access to some of the more expensive psychotropic drugs, which are apparently proving pretty effective for a lot of people, the problem with those is that because the cost of providing those drugs comes out of somebody else's budget, they're not as interested in providing the more expensive drugs because that's their cost, and the fact that it might save the captain money in his system isn't really part of their problem. And I guess I'm wondering, first, I'd like your comment on the drug issue, because it's one I've heard a couple of times, and then secondly, I just, you know, like you'd maybe elaborate a little bit on what you think is the effective way to do that kind of silo busting that you're referencing there.
Let me take a stab at the drug question and then defer to my colleagues on the silo busting. And that I think that it is not a simple answer that I can convey to you in terms of expanded pharmaceutical costs, and that in looking at those budgets, it really requires a nuanced approach. For example, there are antipsychotic medications for the most severe illnesses that are new that the folks will take because they don't have terrible side effects, and in taking them, they then offset a whole bunch of other costs related to them, and so getting rid of those would not be a great idea. Alternatively, there are newer antidepressants out there that, while the side effects are a little bit less, their impact on outcome might not be as dramatic, and that may be an area that you can save considerable money in looking at your formulary budgets. So the point of that example is that I really encourage you to work with the knowledgeable point people in the executive branch and give them the charge of, rather than just a pure black and white, no new drugs or not, let them sort of develop these more nuanced responses to it, and there can be cost savings that accrue from that. Silo busting, integrated efforts. Let me turn to Captain or David.
Okay. An example in Washington State of how we began the process of silo busting. It is a very challenging process. It's something that was referenced in a slide called Senate Bill 6002 in Washington State. This was a bill that was passed a number of years ago, about 5 years ago now, actually, because they've just finished their five-year pilot period. And it's a bill that took $500,000 from the DOC budget, and it required DOC to spend that money collaboratively with the Department of Social and Health Services, DSHS, which runs mental health in Washington State, to target a group of the highest risk, dangerous offenders with severe mental illness who are exiting from the correctional system. The reason that DOC was willing to play was that they didn't want these people back. And they knew that some of these individuals who would be out on parole, or some of these individuals who would be unsupervised and at high risk of reoffense, would be either violated on their parole or right back in the correctional system very quickly if they weren't linked to care. So they agreed to spend money up front if the system could demonstrate an outcome of not bringing them back to the front door of the correctional system again. And what it entailed was having mental health staff and correctional staff work collaboratively, okay, across their silos to first of all identify candidates for the program who were still in DOC custody, and then to begin community-based case management services for those individuals 6 months prior to their release date. So you actually had case managers going into the prison setting, beginning to work with these individuals, building treatment relationships, identifying needs, establishing treatment plans, so that by the time the person 6 months later was at the back door of the prison, they were stepping out into an array of wraparound services that was an alternative to the vacuum of what it's like to go into the community after 20 years in prison. So they had housing, and the housing was linked to intensive case management, to alcohol and drug treatment services, to vocational opportunities, etc. This was difficult to do. For example, the first 24, 48 hours that someone is out of that prison setting are very, very high-risk times for an individual, particularly if they've had a history of substance abuse and are now back in a community where they have ready access to alcohol and drugs. They negotiated working agreements between the mental health provider and the Seattle Police Department, where this program was located, so that when someone was coming out of prison, if necessary, every hour, the police would stop by the residential program and say, "Hey, how's it going? Everything safe here?" Would establish a relationship with the individual offender coming out into the community. The community corrections officers, if the person were on parole, became an integral part of the treatment team, were very present with the treatment team, and were actively engaged with the individual prior to their release and then in the community. What we demonstrated in 5 years of working with this population in this pilot program was that when DOC and DSHS actually pooled their resources and their talents, recidivism for this group of individuals reduced dramatically, to the point where DOC ultimately said, "Boy, this does save us money." And now the current policy is that dollars are attached to every person identified in the state system as a dangerous mentally ill offender. Dollars are attached to them as they are exiting the prison setting that allow them to be engaged in this kind of intensive treatment system. So it actually required the legislature's push. And one of the recommendations that you see here is to encourage state agencies to work together and require collaboration if voluntary efforts are not effective. So legislation that moves the system in this direction, that encourages first perhaps politely, and then if that's resisted, perhaps requires agencies to respond jointly to you in terms of reporting back the results, the outcomes, the findings of their collaborative work, to encourage state agencies to issue collaborative RFPs for services that are provided, that bring together community-based treatment providers and criminal justice agencies, et cetera. There are a number of different strategies which the state legislature is naturally at the head of.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Questions, Representative Brzezinski.
If I can just follow up on that, Mr. Wertheimer. It sounds to me from the way you described your program, the one that was done in Washington State, they're coming out of a state facility. And were they being released into a specific program in King County, or were the in our state they're supposed to be released back to the county that they were sentenced in? And I'm wondering if the legislature had to make some changes to have them go into a specific county where these resources were available.
That's a very good question. And the initial pilot project, the five-year pilot project, was restricted to King County. And the reason King County was selected was that 80% of this population was returning to King County. Actually, in Washington, you get to go to the county you want to go to when you're being released. And a lot of them were from King County to begin with, and others selected to go to King County. So because 80% of this population was coming to King County, that's where the pilot was located. With the new pot of money, post this pilot project, is now being attached to what's called the DMIO population. It's an unfortunate name, but the Dangerous Mentally Ill Offender population. They are now returning to whatever community in Washington State they either came from or choose to go to, and each of the jurisdictions within the state is asked to have a DMIO task force, a group that actually works to ensure that this wraparound package of care is being provided. So it's now statewide.
One follow-up?
Yes.
And how did and your pilot programs work with those local, or maybe this is going to be the second pilot program, working with the local corrections understanding that if they're coming out of a state facility going into the local, is there some connection with the county so maybe dollars are being used because you're offsetting their cost? I'm not sure.
Well, the way it's working primarily in Washington State is that the dollar allocations, because we have a mental health system that is based on these regional networks of care, or our regional support networks, they're called, the state dollars travel to the local locus of mental health treatment authority for mobilization of services, and that RSN is required to work with the local community corrections office, which is where the parole supervision staff sit. And we've, based on a model that actually started in Snohomish County in Everett, which is very much worth studying, the community corrections officers there started something that they call the A-Team. And their A-Team is a group of community corrections officers that pull together from the community, working with the mental health treatment team, whoever is needed to help provide the wraparound package of care that the individual offender returning to the community may require. One of the pieces they've done, for example, which is quite fascinating, is housing is one of the biggest obstacles to stability for this population. Finding stable housing, finding landlords that are willing to rent to this population, finding communities that are willing to tolerate the presence of individuals if they find out about them, etc. One of the things the A-Team in Snohomish County did was they looked at their array of community corrections officers and they decided which one of them would sort of polish up most nicely if the shoes were shined, etc. That individual was given a reduced caseload as a CCO, and in exchange for that, she became the ambassador to landlords in the community, and she spends a fair amount of her time actually recruiting landlords who are interested in perhaps renting to these individuals, so that the A-Team split up its duties and responsibilities in order to maximize its effectiveness. So those teams, which collect mental health, alcohol, drug, all the folks who are involved in care are now working collaboratively to promote that wraparound package of care across multiple systems.
Thank you.
Mr. Wertheimer, in that situation, and you described the pilot project in King County, and we had a program last spring, I think, for members of the Interim Judiciary Committee, where we had Jeremy Travis and some folks come out present on the reentry issues. Mm-hmm. Generally, not necessarily just in the mental health area, but generally the reentry issues. And the housing, obviously, in reentry for any person coming out of the correction system is an issue. More so, I think, in these special needs cases for mental health. Did you, in this King County situation, focus on a particular central locale for some sort of transitional housing?
Yes.
That the county ran, so they had a facility, a group of apartments or a complex that they owned that they actually put people into? I mean, so was it a more controlled housing environment, or was it spread out all over the community?
It was initially a much controlled environment. The first stop for someone coming out of prison was a 16-bed complex that was actually operated by a nonprofit organization in the community which had particular expertise in ex-offender housing. And that was a quite a controlled environment. Everyone was on representative payee. They did not have control over their resources. Individuals at first, when they first come out, have to account for their whereabouts, for the money they spend. They have to bring receipts back if they go to the corner to buy toothpaste or whatever. And gradually, as individuals reacclimated to community living and were able to stabilize, they could be transitioned to other housing that was in the same neighborhood and close to their primary treatment provider, but more independent than the highly supervised setting that folks initially come to.
I would go ahead. You're following a very important line in terms of housing, and it is one of, as David highlighted, the predictors of recidivism. There have been some creative things done in other states around using and prioritizing some of the HUD-subsidized housing certificates and vouchers for people coming out of jails and prisons, and that that is a very important step, I think, in stabilization, and it's very useful in terms of public safety issues as well. On that note, the Council of State Governments, on the back you'll see there's a website there. It's a very interactive website with program examples from arrest through release into the community of what other communities have tried and seen to represent best practices, and that it's a pretty user-friendly site. If you want to know what's going on in Oregon, you click the O and you'll see some of the programs in your home state. Or if you wanted to know what's being done for housing, you can search by those terms as well. So there are a number of examples that we'd encourage folks to look at in terms of response to the population.
I want to follow the housing line just a little bit with the Seattle project. So to the extent that you had the 16-bed facility, how long would the released offender stay in that facility before transitioning, assuming that they met the test? I assume if they screwed up because they were on parole, they were put back in. But the ones that stayed, how long did you have to transition them out?
Well, that's an interesting and complicated question. The length of stay was really based on clinical variables rather than a calendar. So as a person progressed in their own stabilization and recoveries, I would say on average people probably stay between 9 and 16 to 18 months in that initial housing setting while they're stabilizing. Individuals who slipped were not necessarily immediately revoked. It depends on what happened. If they committed another criminal offense, the revocation, of course, occurred because new charges were filed. But there were occasional early relapse issues that would surface. Someone would come back to the facility drunk, and it's clean and sober living. That did not necessarily result in a revocation, but rather in a more intensive intervention around alcohol and drug issues. One of the errors we made, for example, and I was initially responsible for the mobilization of this program, and one of the errors that we made, which cost us dearly at first, was thinking, okay, if somebody's been in prison for 20 years and they may have had an alcohol and drug problem when they went into prison, but they probably don't have it when they come out. They're 20 years supposedly clean and sober while they're incarcerated. So we'll set up the drug and alcohol screening for the first 2 weeks after they're released. Big mistake. 5 minutes after they're released is too late for that alcohol and drug screening to occur. It needs to occur while they're still incarcerated. And a very clear and specific treatment plan that incorporates alcohol and drug relapse issues has to be in place before the person walks out the back door of that prison. We learned that one the hard way. So it goes back to the co-occurring disorders theme and how critical it is to address the full range of treatment needs a person brings with them.
So despite the fact that they had sort of been under a forced clean and sober requirement within the first couple of weeks of getting back out, even though they theoretically had no access to those substances while in prison, they were right back on it.
Kid in a candy shop.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's like when I was in Europe for 2 years and I came back having not had a Taco Bell.
Yeah.
I can't eat another burrito supreme, by the way.
Representative Shetterly.
Not so much a question, but just a reflection and I guess an expression of frustration as we're hearing this today and having sat it now for this being my fourth term on judiciary. This is information that we've known for some time. I mean, it's presented, it's new, but it tells essentially the same story. Where you get the most bang for your buck, it's on the prevention side and a transition of offenders back into community. As we are today releasing how many prisoners from Multnomah County jail with absolutely no transition, and we know that the percentages and the pathologies that they're going to be bringing with them out onto the streets are just exactly what you're talking about here. So we know what to do. It's frustrating not to be doing it. One question I'd have, Mr. Wertheimer, specific to a program we saw, and it's related to this. It was the Bill. Help me out. 5 years ago, was it roughly that we went up to McNeil Island and looked at the sex offender post-incarceration civil commitment program? I'm just curious what you're doing with that these days. I know there's litigation involving that. I remember we met with the director, and he asked us if he knew, if any of us knew of a good job that he could have.
That's
this
correct.
Thing was just tanking. What's going on there? What lessons have you learned now 5 years post our visit?
I'm happy to answer that question. It takes us in a slightly different direction, but should I? I'm happy to answer the question.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. And it's heating up dramatically because we're now under court order in Washington State to actually provide community-based housing for some of these individuals who have been identified as sex offenders.
You were then housing them all in McNeil Island,
right? And now they're returning to the community. And in South King County, near where I live, just last week there was they're trying to find siting housing. And more than 2,000 people showed up at a community meeting because they were the third community that the county was trying to site housing in, and 2,000 residents showed up to say they didn't want it there. What has happened at the state level is that, again, through a collaboration between the State Department of Corrections and the Department of Social and Health Services, we've initiated something, a project that I'm actually working as a consultant for. We're calling it the Partnership for Community Safety. And I could talk for hours about this, I won't. But in a nutshell, what the Partnership for Community Safety is attempting to do is develop strategies for successful housing of level 3 sex offenders and dangerous mentally ill offenders in the community. And we had a huge partnership team that was co-chaired by the Director of Sexual Assault Programs for Washington State and a representative of Catholic Community Services, two of the most respected providers. We brought in a broad array not only of mental health and drug alcohol treatment providers, sexual assault, sexual offender treatment providers, but also survivors of violent crime, family members, others who were very concerned about this issue. And we agreed as a principle that the most important issue in terms of reducing recidivism and reoffense for sex offenders was, again, stable housing. When you know where someone is, and when you're able to find them in order to supervise them, the risk of reoffense for a sex offender goes down dramatically. And when you involve the neighborhood in that process, you have even better results. If you have a mentoring program in the neighborhood, for example, and you have a sex offender who's moved into a neighborhood and is living by himself and has a history of having assaulted children, and you begin to see toys in his front yard, you begin to get concerned. And your neighbors, if they're observing the neighborhood and what's going on, will know who to call, etc. So the Partnership for Community Safety has been formed to do two things. It's two sort of tipping points. One is to promote community understanding of the fact that these people are returning to the community anyway and will do much better and be at lower risk of reoffense if they are housed stably, and we know where they're housed. And the second tipping point related to that is to find individuals who are willing to rent to individuals identified as level 3 sex offenders. The next phase of this Partnership for Community Safety, which has just begun in January this month, we have four communities around the state, Spokane, Clark County, Whatcom County, and King County, who have all agreed to pilot test this concept of housing, community education, landlord recruitment, to see if we can make a dent in this issue. It's much too early to know what our results are going to be from those four pilot areas, but it is a major issue for the state at this point, and one that in terms of the public hue and cry and the concern that the public has expressed about the population overshadows the mentally ill offender population enormously. It's a very, very hot button issue in our state right now.
Let me back up. I don't want us to lose, and we'll see if there are any other questions, and then we can end. But I don't want to lose sort of the thread of where we were talking about. And I had another question, because it sounds like what you did in Washington is you focused on that dangerously mental ill offender category, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about what that's defined as. And then secondly, I noticed that in the data, though, most of your costs, especially for folks like Captain here, are actually in that misdemeanor category, which wouldn't fit your dangerously mental ill category. So you've got the one over here that's probably driving the big public hue and cry and that you want to watch the most closely and invest some resources on, but the actual resource expense, at least through the jail population, is in the part that are doing the small-time offenses. And what are you doing to counter that, since they're the biggest cost to your system? At, what was it, 10% of your...
Misdemeanors usually, I think, 70% of the jail bed days.
70% of your jail beds.
And that's something of a state versus county level debate in Washington State. I'm not quite sure how it's configured in Oregon, but it's the county jails in Washington that are primarily responsible for housing offenders who are misdemeanor offenders or who are going to be spending 12 months or less in custody.
Yeah,
and if it's 12 months or more,
that's exactly what we do.
They go to the state.
Right.
So the local nickel and dime criminal, the person who may be engaged in criminal activities because of drug-seeking behavior or other reasons, is a county problem as the state sees it. And the counties must figure out how to deal with this with the resources they have in their jails and in their community systems. And the dangerous mentally ill offender, the person who has been serving hard time for felony offenses in the state correctional system, is seen as a state issue and a state problem. problem. The categorization of DMIO, dangerously mentally ill offenders, is actually a relatively small group of individuals, several hundred people statewide in Washington, who, based on the nature of their offense and the screening that's done by the Department of Corrections while they're in custody, are identified as being at the highest risk of reoffense, of violent crime, upon release to the community. And it's a fairly complicated screening procedure that they use, but it's a fairly small group of individuals who are perceived to be the greatest risk to the community.
Could you provide us at some point, obviously it doesn't have to be today, but a set of those screening factors
Yes.
that the committee could look at to see what you've categorized in that category?
I'd be happy to.
I'm actually interested, Captain, in what you've done. I assume that this issue isn't completely unique to the western states, where you've got, on the one hand, focus on the most dangerous folks is where people want to spend the resources for obvious reasons, but the ones that are costing you your jail operation dollars on a daily basis is the small misdemeanor or the large misdemeanor population that's turning over so frequently. What have you done in New York?
What we have done is we have a local mental health committee in Monroe County. It's made up of three judges, two city court judges and one state Supreme Court judge. It's represented by the district attorney's office, the head of the public defender's office, who also was involved in the consensus project, so that there was a big help to us. Myself from the corrections side and the city police department, Rochester City Police Department, is represented along with the Monroe County Mental Health Clinic. So we're trying to bring in the mental health community to talk to us to figure out, you know, where we're going with this. And basically what we're trying to do is bring in as many people from the mental health community to sit, and what we're trying to do, because we know our costs are spiraling out of control and that we need more and more mental health coverage in the jail, particularly because in New York State we have the New York State Commission of Corrections, who is our watchdog group, you know, really holding a hard hammer over us at the local jail level, saying you guys got to do more, you got to get more mental health coverage in these jails, you got to do more on a daily basis. We are trying to work with the University of Rochester, hopefully, to bring an intern on board to take a look at the cost from the time the law enforcement officer on the street arrests that person, really quantify the cost of bringing that person to the local emergency room, bringing them to the jail, bringing them through the court system, and take that and then taking a look at what community-based treatment programs, and again, housing is the biggest piece, again, for us, what we can do with those individuals, so that we also have a couple of groups that are looking at some SAMHSA grants to look at a local drop-in center, so that the drop-in center has those mental health nurses and people there to try to divert them from having to come to jail. We want to try to get the local law enforcement officers not to arrest these people and have an alternative prior to them coming to the jail. So that's the biggest focus we have. This group has been meeting for about the last 6 to 9 months, and hopefully if we can get the cost really structured and down, then we can bring in the other folks to see where we can go, you know, what housing is available in the community and what the mental health community can do for us in terms of staffing those kinds of housing and bringing the resources to see these people in the housing that's provided and make sure that they stay on their medications so they don't have another encounter with the local law enforcement officers. So that's the biggest push for us, because we've got to get that number down. I mean, we can't. Monroe County is the same as Oregon. We are crushed for dollars. Our budget, we are in a budget crisis in Monroe County. We just recently raised taxes, which is very difficult in the community. It's losing more and more jobs.
Don't we know it?
Rochester is Xerox and Kodak and Bausch & Lomb, and they are all downsizing, and it's critical for our community. So we, in the criminal justice system, are trying to figure out ways that we can reduce our budget, because our budgets have gone up and up and up. I started in 1984. We had a jail population of 320 inmates with 125 correction officers. And I stand before you today telling you that we have 1,400 inmates, two facilities, and almost 500 correction officers. I mean, I never realized in 1984 that I was going to be in a growing concern, especially of this magnitude.
When all your area businesses seem to be going just the opposite direction. Yeah.
It's unfortunate. And to tell you how bad it is, you know, we have 43 new deputies in our academy. Out of the 43, we have 7 from Xerox, 6 from Kodak, another 5 from Valeo, which was he worked in the auto industry. And these are people that have 10 and 15 years in those private companies, and they're coming to work in a jail. I mean, what does it say for us? We've got to make a change, and we've got to do something to try to divert especially these low-level offenders who are just busting at the seams with them, and we just don't have those dollars.
Thanks, Captain. That was very helpful. Are there any other questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was interested in your explanation that you have some people going in before the prisoner is released and working with them a little. We've had very good experience at a youth authority jail in my hometown, where we've had a number of adults going in and relating to kids and building friendships and relationships, talking with them, reading with them. Is there any help in reducing recidivism with the mentally ill, with relationships like that being developed, to get local citizens going into the prisons and trying to reach out before they're released in the adult population?
In the adult population, I would say yes. Depends on there's a very interesting program in King County called the Mental Health Chaplaincy. And the Mental Health Chaplaincy is run by an exceptional man by the name of Craig Rennebaum. He actually won a National Mental Health Award that one of the first ladies, I forget how long ago it was, but he's an amazing guy. And what he has created what he calls, it's a program that creates what he calls welcoming congregations. And he's worked with a number of churches in the community to become welcoming communities to individuals, particularly of histories of homelessness, mental illness, and involvement with the criminal justice system. And I will say that they primarily use their trained chaplain corps to reach out into settings where people are incarcerated. But once the individual returns to the community, members of the congregations actually become a welcoming landing pad and source of support for a number of individuals who are coming back to the community. So they don't actually, I don't think there are many lay people that go into the prisons or jail themselves, but the community certainly becomes involved.
One of the things that Representative Williams identified was the fragmentation of the services that are required from someone coming out of a jail and prison setting, and that while the development of relationship with community citizens is undoubtedly valid on the face of it, in terms of coordinating the care that's necessary, we find that case managers and case management is really the staff person that seems to make the biggest difference in a person getting what they need when they leave. And gosh, we would much rather have the Xerox and Kodak folks coming to be case managers at our mental health center than correctional staff within the jail. And that would be, you know, a nice labor shift if we could achieve it. But I think we want to not minimize the real needs of a mentally ill offender. They're pretty comprehensive. The friendship, social supports, peer supports, relationships important, but beyond that is a coordination of their care system needs.
I follow that.
You may, Representative.
Obviously, and I think our chairman mentioned how important the psychotropic drugs are in bringing people into balance. If they are in balance, basically, and that's another question, do you have the medications to be able to treat most of these patients? But if they are treated, is that the point at which adult relationships can be worked?
Yeah, I think that there are, everyone's an individual and requires their own treatment plan, but certainly for the most disabling illnesses, we have a great pharmacologic response, mm-hmm. and that I had the privilege of being on the White House Health Care Reform Task Force, and that we stacked our pharmacologic interventions against any other health field. We have better response rates than you do for coronary artery disease in terms of medications, and that what we need to do is assure that there's some access to them. When those symptoms are under better control, we have a whole recovery model now in mental health that really has demonstrated that folks with these serious mental illnesses can return to work and actually become our taxpaying citizens with the appropriate treatment, interventions, and supports.
Great. Further questions?
Well, if I could respond really quickly to that, one of the things that many of the people who worked on the project who are consumers in the mental health system, meaning people with mental illness, have pointed out is the usefulness and the value of peer support services, so that that connection could be specifically to another person with mental illness who had been involved in the justice system, and that not that there's necessarily an enormous amount of data about the effectiveness of that, but that it's a growing thing that mental health systems are turning to, and actually what some people say is that it's a huge untapped resource that those peers can be valuable contributors to the improvement and care of other people.
In relation to that, it may be worth looking at what they're doing in the state of Connecticut right now. I've been working recently with them. The state of Connecticut mental health system, the commissioner is moving the entire system towards a recovery model of care for people with severe and persistent mental illnesses. And I was in Connecticut several months ago at a remarkable meeting where I sat in a room doing a focus group with 25 people with severe and persistent mental illness, primary diagnosis was schizophrenia. And through the use of peer supports, through the use of reconnections to their families, to their communities, to their families of choice, these are individuals who most of them, as the time progressed, started looking at their watches and said, Mr. Wertheimer, could you wrap this up? I have to get to work in an hour. Mm-hmm. And to hear that from a population which in many states are still considered to be not employable, to see what's happening in Connecticut is quite remarkable. Recovery is within reach for many, many of the individuals with a combination of effective antipsychotic medications, professional case management, and strong peer and community supports.
And access, of course, to those antipsychotic medications usually requires access to some sort of a health care program which might provide those antipsychotic medications. Steve.
Thank you. The captain mentioned having to release an inmate who served his time, and you recognized as having problems. And also, a lot of officers on the street see people who they know are on the verge, but Oregon has a very high threshold in our what we call involuntary commitment process. You have to be of imminent danger to yourself or others, and then before you're taken in. So often, in fact, we just had a death in my district of one that was reviewed. They knew he had problems, but then they couldn't take him into custody. Are there any statutory changes along those lines that you would suggest?
You hit on an area where there isn't consensus. That the involuntary outpatient commitment, the gravely disabled standards that many states have adopted, are questionable in terms of their long-term effect on outcomes for the category of folks that they would be imposed on. And so in the consensus project, we acknowledge that there's a variety of efforts out there to address those, but when we look at the research, it's inconclusive as to whether they make a difference in outcomes for those folks. So that's why we didn't take a position on it, and it's a topic that deserves a really rich debate.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Brzezinski, then Representative Shetterly.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that's interesting, Representative Shetterly brought it up as to just the reentry in the general population. There is a program that we actually had that was a pilot program through DLC with an organization and a nonprofit in Eugene. Sponsors did, and it was a two-year program. And they called it Winners, and it had exactly the components that you're talking about: intensive case management. It took care of housing, job, education, training, whatever it took to get them employed, A&D treatment, and then drug testing. And they had somewhere between 29 and 39 people that entered the program, and after 1 year, all but one was in complete compliance. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things, I guess, from my point of frustration, seeing something that has actually been demonstrated to work, but for whatever reason, DLC did not move it into a greater use in throughout the state. And it just seems like from that, and that was back in probably the mid-90s, mm-hmm. that we could draw on that and use it in the components that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's been very appreciative hearing your thoughts. Mm-hmm.
I would have been kind of connected to providers in Oregon for a couple of decades. You've had many bright lights here. There are some of the most creative programs in the country have been developed here, and I know some are on the chopping blocks and some are really struggling for their survival, but there probably is a way to engage your, you know, provider networks in an effort to preserve what's best here, keep what's strong, and keep what's evidence-based and effective, and, you know, that's what every state's struggling with at this moment is, you know.
And therein lies the problem with a fragmented program, is it's awfully difficult to know where everything fits in the universe of these programs, how they interrelate, how they're interconnected. Yeah. Each one sometimes gets its source of funding through some cooperation of monies, which at the 30,000-foot level, you can't follow it. I mean, it's almost impossible for us to know. And so that's one of the challenges we face. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I was curious back on the psychotropic drugs as reflected in the consensus project. Is there consensus on psychotropic drugs? My experience from our work group efforts here has been some difference, especially among consumers, as to the mm-hmm. utility and the role of psychotropic drugs and the role of the state, I guess, in, let's say, enforcing compliance. Where do you see the consensus breakdown on the issue of psychotropic drugs in your work group efforts?
Mm-hmm. There's little debate about the effectiveness of these agents, and when one looks at all the evidence over time and a variety of conditions, that the use of appropriate pharmacology in the right amounts over time are associated with all the good outcomes that we would care about. I think there is a breakdown when we talk about compliance issues. You know, is it practical, reasonable, respectful of civil liberties to require or mandate somebody that doesn't wish to take medications to do so? And that is something that's got to be reviewed on a case-by-case basis, and there are certainly arguments to be made for that happening and arguments to be made against it. The utility and effectiveness of agents are unquestionable. But how they're applied, how they're monitored, and whether they can be forced or not, that always raises concerns among constituents.
What were your... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative McPherson.
Well, I just want to pursue one of the themes that's kind of woven through a number of the questions in the discussion here, and it's a question, I think, probably for Mr. Wertheimer or Dr. Osher, whichever would care to respond. And that's about this relationship between housing and recidivism. And... trying to sort out a view as to whether or not the housing that's most effective is housing that has the offenders together, maybe in group housing or in adjacent housing, so they're more susceptible to supervision and can draw on maybe the positive peer influences that were being described here a moment ago, or whether they are better off more dispersed, where they're perhaps gaining advantage or maybe improvement through the contact with what we would call quote unquote more normal society. Do you have any? Is there any learning on this? Do you have perspectives that you could share with us?
Yeah, you're raising questions that are in understudy at this time. There are general principles that one wants to follow in this, and that from the consumer perspective, not having many institutions, not being kind of put together in one spot is preferred, and scattered site housing with appropriate supports has been proven to be successful in integrating consumers, not necessarily the mentally ill offender, but generally consumers into communities. So that is a notion that we've learned from our consumers as a preference, and it seems to be supported by the literature. In terms of folks coming out with the DMIO categorization and some of the more important public safety concerns that get raised by those individuals, I think we're still in a learning mode around what works best for them. And certainly the Seattle Project, as we heard it described just last month, has a lot of credence to it in terms of halfway housing. And there used to be, as I understand it, even in Oregon, a network of halfway housing for folks coming out of institutional settings that kind of disappeared over the last 5 or 10 years. And that I think there's experience in this state with that as a step down towards integration that would inform the argument. My answer is, for many, many folks, the vast majority without a lot of high public safety risk, they prefer and can live in scattered site housing. For those high at risk, then it makes sense to think about these transitional opportunities and get a little bit of community time and then move forward into more integrated settings.
I would add, I think Fred's absolutely correct. And there's a natural tension in this discussion between the desire to live as independently as possible in the community and not be ghettoized in a project that is limited to mentally ill offenders, that tension on one hand, between the tension on the other hand of the desire to provide efficient services when resources are limited. And when individuals are clustered geographically in one area, it's much easier to provide case management to those individuals and to keep tabs on them than it is if you have to have a case manager who's driving all over a county which has a combination of rural and urban settings in order to identify and meet with their clients. And when the demand for caseload size and caseload ratios goes up when your resources go down, it becomes easier to manage clients when they're clustered, but that, again, is in tension with what clients may desire or what may cause them to thrive most effectively in the community. One exception to this, I will note, going back to our discussion about registered sex offenders, is the experience in Seattle with that population is that for sex offenders who have been through treatment while incarcerated successfully, which means primarily bottom line that they have accepted accountability for their offenses, okay, they've accepted responsibility for what they've done. For sex offenders returning to the community in that group, successfully completing treatment while incarcerated, clustered housing actually seems to reduce recidivism. Clustered housing meaning that they're in the same building, they're keeping eyes on each other, they're helping each other in a community way to not slip into whatever behavior patterns may have led to offense in the first place. While statistically that may be a more effective model of care in terms of reducing recidivism, it's a model that totally terrifies a neighborhood. So, again, there are some natural tensions in how to approach that, but that model is specific to sex offenders.
The other thing I've mentioned, Representative McPherson, is it's interesting, at least in my prior conversations with folks at the Department of Corrections, they have a pretty good ability to identify as they're releasing somebody back into a community generally where they're going to be, down to neighborhoods and targeted zip code areas, and you'll find oftentimes a pretty strong correlation based on socioeconomic factors where some of these people are going to end up. And if you build a housing component solution that focused on that data, you could potentially address some of those issues immediately, bearing in mind that neighborhoods where that's going to be aren't necessarily going to be happy about being the repository of large numbers of these folks. Okay, we very much appreciate the presentations today and what I hope for the committee was an interesting and stimulating discussion of a pretty significant issue. Council Taylor has some comments he wants.
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Swain said he'd be glad to get more copies of these books. I've already passed out about 20. We passed out two committees this morning. We have two left now, but he would send me more if anyone wants, and if I could get an idea of how many people would like copies of this. So another dozen would be probably cover everyone.
If that can be done.
The other thing is, the chair wanted me to mention once again the next Monday and Tuesday at 1:00 in the afternoon. We'll be meeting down in Hearing Room F with the Law Enforcement Subcommittee of Ways and Means, Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and the Human Resources Subcommittee of Ways and Means Committee. This will be a two-day presentation on something we have never done before, and that will be, first off, a presentation on the whole criminal justice system. So it'll be not just include police, it will include the courts, it will include jails, prisons. It will include treatment, it will include his defense, so when you get through, you'll have a total understanding of the system. We will also hear case studies, basically, of walking individuals through the system, so not only have you heard the abstract issues, but the practical issues that are involved in people going through the system. And finally, we're getting recommendations from all these participants. I've met with heads of the Department of Corrections, the Youth Authority, the courts. We've had a group of about 30 that have helped put this together. And you finally will hear on what legislative recommendations they have. I've talked to the chair and I've talked to others. One of the problems, the area that we have the most effect is prevention and treatment. It's also the area that is, the other areas, you're not really, the courts don't reduce recidivism rates, except when they have drug courts. Programs and treatment are intended to do that. One of the hardest things to do is to evaluate these programs and to figure out where we should put our resources. And that's the next step that we're going to try to do. It's, once again, it's something we've never done.
What is the schedule on that? What days?
Monday and Tuesday.
Monday and Tuesday.
And it will be during the time of our regular committee meeting, but we'll be meeting jointly with those two Ways and Means subcommittees. And this is the first time, colleagues, that we've ever done this. It's part of my effort and Representative Patridge, who chairs the Ways and Means Subcommittee for Public Safety's effort, to begin to coordinate more fully the policy operations of this committee with the spending operations of the Ways and Means Committee, and not have the distance between the third floor of this building and the first floor of this building be 1,000 miles, as it has been in many previous sessions. So I can't encourage you, and we've included, obviously, the Health and Human Subcommittee folks in this discussion, because as you've heard today, this is a seamless network of social situations that spill over. I can't encourage you enough to be there, to be a part of this, because it will inform many of the choices that we're going to be forced to make, particularly based on what happened last night and the impacts that we anticipate both for the balance of the 0103 and looking forward into the 0305 budget and the policy choices we're going to have to make as we develop these budget solutions to these problems. So it's perhaps maybe two of the most important days of committee work we're going to do this session. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned.